Welcome to the Brain Fever Podcast. This is a story of Jackie Stebbins, who is a lawyer, a mother, a wife, and an autoimmune encephalitis survivor. She wishes to tell her story about her fight with autoimmune encephalitis and her recovery. Now, here's your host, Jackie Stebbins.
Sometimes I don't know the difference between summer and winter and the season of spring. Sometimes I don't know how happy to be, because nothing's forever, baby.
Hey y'all, welcome back to another episode of Brain Fever. I think it's even a new season because I don't think we have published since last fall. Most of that is because I have too many irons in the fire and Sean gets tired of editing my lengthy podcast. So we are turning over a new leaf, folks. You are here for it. The Jackie Stebbins is going to try to hold herself to 45 minutes, and I hate doing it today because I have such a great guest. So as we sit here today, it is February of 2024. Yesterday, we just celebrated the 5th annual World Encephalitis Day, 2nd Encephalitis Day in North Dakota. Thank you to everyone who Bismarck Brainwalked. So much fun. And as I had so much going on this week, I finally connected on Instagram with a date and said, Jesse, we're podcasting. So today with me, I have Jesse Beter. And my God, I love her. And here's the thing. I don't want to. I want to get really mad at her because she's so talented. But I love her, even though she's way more talented than I could ever possibly be. So I'm going to just run through a few of the things, hearing Sean in mind, like, cut your intros and your interviews. Okay, so Jesse is a blogger. She is a podcaster. She is a fourth generation farm and ranch girl, near and dear to my heart, lives in a smaller town in Watford City, North Dakota. She writes a weekly newspaper column. She is a singer and songwriter, which I really love about her. And reading this morning, she started singing at age 10, which is so cool. Cut an album at 16. I was streaming her music this morning. You can just hit Spotify or Apple and look for Jesse Beter, and you're going to be singing a song about a girl and her dog all morning. She writes poetry. She's got a children's book, Prairie Princess. She's got a new album called Yellow Roses that she cut in Nashville. Like, she is legit cool. So I'm going to do a quick story because if I didn't, it wouldn't be me. It wouldn't be Brain Fever. So here's how I meet Jesse. I have the news on one day and I see this story, and I don't know if I realized it was older. It was a few years old, about this beautiful, wonderful woman who sings, and she and her husband. Oh, and by the way, again, her perfect life. She has two cute daughters and a handsome cowboy husband. Again, so she's so lucky she's lovable, or I wouldn't love her the way I do. So I see this story. She's this singer, you know, songwriter, and she had overcome cancer. And of course, my ears perk up because, you know, chronic health is kind of my jam these days. So, okay, I see this lady, kind of catalog it. Well, a while later, I'm asked to do this, like a panel discussion of local authors. And here's this woman, Jesse Beter, and I connected it. Actually, I think Sean did. And I was like, oh yeah, I just saw a news story about her. Okay, so here's the fun story. And this is why Jesse's such a good sport. We're going to have fun with this. So this is like June. I go to this place. Honest to God, I am not only on time, I'm a hair early. But I was so insignificant to this panel, they had started without me. So I'm like mortified. I go up and I sit by Jesse, because of course I want to be her best friend because I can tell she's cool. So she was by far the most talented person on the panel and everyone loved her. And here's how she opens up like her portion. She's blushing now. She's literally talking about racing around and she's creative and she lives on a farm and she's got these kids. And she's like, I got to Bismarck and I realized I don't even have a bra on. And I was like, I love this lady and I want to be her friend. So she was the highlight of the panel. I realized that people were calling me the wrong name. I was so confused. No one cared about me in my book because you got Jesse Beter, the Taylor Swift of North Dakota over here. And finally, I like look at the program. They had my name as Julie. I'm like, this is awful. And then a lady stole a book from me. I know she didn't mean to. She was like flipping through it. And she's like, oh, and she just like walked off without paying me. And I was like, at this point, I don't care. My name's Julie. Jessie doesn't have a bra. I think she had found one, by the way. I think she went shopping. But this is the kind of person she is. I love her. And today, I think we're really gonna look at Jessie's cancer diagnosis and treatment and, you know, how that interrupted her life and maybe the creativity she sparked from there, because I think that's what Brain Fever listeners would really be interested to hear. So, no more of my rambles. I'm looking at my time. I'm too far along. But Jessie, welcome to the Brain Fever podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm feeling like I'm shrinking as you're talking about me because it isn't glamorous, but it is. I can't help myself.
She's super glamorous. She told me she wouldn't look nice this morning, and spoiler alert, she looks nice. So we're already angry at her. But you know what's redeeming? That when I was reading about her this morning, she has performed with Sammy Kershaw and Joe Diffie, and I'm a 90s country music lover. I love both of them. You need to tell me what that was like.
You know, being an opening act is interesting because sometimes you get to see the person, and a lot of times you just don't. You're just there, you know, you're there. So, but it's fun to, gosh, in my life, I've got to meet Susie Boggess, and in per my husband got to meet Wynonna Judd on the street of Watford City. So there's been some, you know, brushes with these people, but I am a terrible fan because I feel like they don't want to talk to me. They don't want to see me. I'm just gonna like admire them from afar and stay out of their way. And so I have no good celeb encounter stories other than like I saw Fred Eagle Smith, which nobody knows who he is, in a dive bar, and I wouldn't even talk to him because I'm too like embarrassed and nervous. So yeah.
This is what I love about Jessie. So when I told her that I was going to try to keep the podcast at 45 minutes, she said that she was going to keep her Lutheranism
It under control.
minimal. I'm dying. And she's super funny too. Usually if I have some kind of aging millennial story, she'll laugh at it on Instagram. And
Of
she's
course.
also very good with like self-deprecating millennial humor. So she's our kind of people, Brain Fever people. I need to teach her how to be a better stalker, though. That is a quality I have that apparently she could use some tips on. Okay, so we're gonna get serious for a minute, Jesse. So I have heard that when you hear, you know, the C word cancer in your life and you're with the doctor, that it's obviously terrorizing and devastating and life-changing. So kind of give me an idea, like where were you at in life, your age and stage when you found out that you had this rare cancer in essentially like your airwaves in your throat?
You and I have a similar story. I was raising two little kids. I think, boy, I'm terrible at math, but if I remember correctly, 2 and 4, my daughters were 2 and 4. That's right in the middle of like the mess of just that's a hard stage of parenting anyway. And I had been struggling with breathing, really noticeable. Throughout a year, I think it kind of was on and off, and trying to figure it out with my local physicians. And it was one of those things where you're young and you have young kids and you're in the middle of your life. I was recording an album, I had like plans, I was building a nonprofit. There's no way this could be anything serious. I just thought it was something that I couldn't get over, like a cold or asthma. And it's a kind of a long story there. And there's a lot to be said about advocacy for yourself as a patient and a person and treating yourself as a person. I mean, really, I wasn't giving myself that sort of sit back and think about what's actually happening to your body is like screaming at you, but I was ignoring it. Other people in my life were sort of looking at me like, this is not right, but we couldn't figure it out. And that's kind of been the story of a lot of my health journey. We had that with infertility as well. So I was kind of had that in my, you kind of have that as your PTSD. I've had an experience with infertility that sent me down paths that were never successful. We had 7 miscarriages. Sometimes you just shut down with when you don't get any answers. I was there for a year with my breathing and what we thought was asthma that I'd never had before, thinking like, well, there's nothing anyone can do about this. This is just something that I'm gonna have to deal with. Whatever, it's fine. Whatever, it's fine. We're fine. We're all fine.
Yep, it's all
Anyway,
fine.
it's all fine. Yeah, the house is on fire, but I just kept like trucking.
Yep.
And but that's the thing about your health, you know, like there's something going on with you and you can ignore it only for so long. I finally got into a specialist after I had flown to the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering, got super sick, had to, and this is down in Nevada, sang. Every time I was on stage, I would take a breathing treatment before, get on stage, give everything I had, get off stage, basically collapse. I shouldn't have been flying. I shouldn't have been there. I shouldn't have made it there. But when I got to Bismarck to see a pulmonary specialist, he said it sounds immediately. And I went by myself. I thought I was just going to get some medicine. I drove the 3 hours by myself, left my kids and husband home. I'll be back tonight. I was not back that night. He said, "You have a blockage. We're going to do a CT scan. Do you want to do it today?" Yeah. I went and did the contrast CT, drove home thinking I'd just get the results, phoned in, and he called me when I hit New Salem and said, "You need to come back here, and you need to call your husband." And so you asked me what it feels like to, have that diagnosis. I still had no idea. But when my husband came and we sat down and looked at the CT scan, there was a huge, I mean, when I say huge, of course, I don't even know how big it actually was, but a blockage in my airway where my lungs dissect that was blocking most, pretty much 100% of one of my lungs and 90 or 80% of the other. And then you're just staring at it like, well, what the hell? No one saw this. This is what's going on. This explains it. So to answer that question of what it's like, it's when you get a diagnosis of something you've been struggling with, trying to figure out what it is, it's a part relief. More of that was like relief, like, oh, now we know at least. And I don't even remember thinking anything other than that, kind of like, thank you. Now I know it was a giant airway blockage. Okay. And then where it got scary was when it was like, well, we need to figure out what this is and we're going to cut you open. And the path that leads you down to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing gives you different fears and different, because it's a process. It's not like they just look at it and say, this is this cancer and this is what you're going to do. It's like, this needs to come out of you. My doctor can't do it. You need to go to Mayo Clinic. And from there, it just spiraled on to how this all was going to shake out. Because that's the cancer and the health journey, that it's a journey. It's not a diagnosis and fix tomorrow. It's constant. And it still is in my life and as it is in yours. So.
So I hear two things from you, Jesse. Well, three. One, like I hear your strength. It's such a cowgirl. Like I'm fine. This is why you and I think relate, and we've never really covered this, but that kind of stubborn stupidity of like I am fine, and I'm just gonna go there, and they're gonna toss medicine. I'm gonna drive 3 hours home, and like I'm fine. It's all fine. Yeah, not fine. And then you're like by yourself. So okay, I hear strength, stubborn stupidity, which I love about you, and can relate to, but I hear two other things. I hear like perspective and I hear uncertainty. And I think those are things that I use all the time in my writing and speaking. We have definitely covered this on the podcast. Your perspective shows a lot about you, right? That you're like, well, thank God they found something. And I get for all of us, when you're dealing with the uncertainty, sometimes a horrid diagnosis is like, okay, it's an answer. So I hear that perspective. Let's kind of start with that. How have you managed to kind of keep your perspective? You were trying to cut an album at that time. You are trying to raise girls. You're trying to farm and ranch. Your husband, I believe, maybe still worked like a full-time job in the oil field. You had so much. How did you try to keep perspective and keep going with, oh my God, now I've worked cancer into my life too?
I think everyone, oh gosh, I have so much to say about that because it also landed in a time that's so completely inconvenient, as if you can have any control over it. But and this is kind of what happened to you too. The timing of it was husband gets laid off of oil field job. Jesse cuts an album, that's an expense, with a tumor in my airway, by the way. I cut the whole thing where I couldn't breathe, but I could sing. What an idiot. Like you can, I did that. And raising these two girls, then COVID happens, and Chad starts his new business as a contractor, and he's gonna just be on the ranch too with my dad. So big life changes. COVID happens, the world shuts down. I still can't breathe. Maybe it was COVID. We have this whole national, international, world pandemic while in your little world, everything completely, my little world, everything was crumbling too. And so the perspective was just like, you don't have a choice here. There's nothing you can do but put one foot in front of the other, or it will all just implode upon you. So people would say, like, your outlook and you're so positive and da 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 da. But I kind of got a little bit like, what's the word? I want to be really honest because there was a moment where I was like, I don't want people to tell me I'm so strong here. There's two things happening. I didn't know if what how my life was going to be affected by the surgery or the cancer at this. There was a point where they were trying to figure out what it was. They took the tumor out with a scope, so that was a simple procedure. I could breathe again, but then they had to cut me open, like an open heart surgery incision, maybe put me on bypass and take the tumor off of the outside of my airway by clipping my airway and then putting it back together, but not taking too much because you can't, then you're dead. So, not to be dramatic, but that's the truth.
But it's
So
quite dramatic.
luckily,
Like you were
yeah,
living
it's
that.
pretty.
Yeah,
So
for
could I
real.
sing after this? Could
Yep.
I
Be
didn't
alive.
care if I could ever talk again. I had two little girls and there was no way I wasn't. I can't even say this without losing it or to this day. There was no way I wasn't going to be there for them. I waited so long for these kids. There was not a chance that I wasn't going to be there. So, sorry, every time I say it, but
No,
I
it's
think when
important.
you're single or you're married and you don't have these kids attached to you, they're your responsibility. Being sick like that would have been a different, would have hit different if I wasn't a mom. And because you all of a sudden realize that I will ruin their life if I die. And so I just remember thinking with my husband one day, we were driving and I felt like really panicked to do all of the things while I felt good before the surgery. Like we scheduled the surgery. And I was like, but first, let's get branding done because I need to have all my family and do this thing and feel like I'm normal before it all hits the fan. So I was allowed to do that. But to this other point where people were like, gosh, you have such a great outlook. A, I think I'm going to be okay. And B, like, I am pissed off too about this. Like, this is annoying. I'm in pain. I'm trying to navigate this. I'm not a saint. My kids still annoy the hell out of me. I still have to do the dishes. I still have to like manage this life. Plus, I have cancer and I'm feeling annoyed by it. And so I don't want people to think that I'm just like in this such a grateful mode all the time. Although I do believe being grateful propels you and keeps you going. And so that's the other answer to your question. I just wanted to be very honest that it wasn't easy and I also didn't have a choice whether or not to go through it. As everybody who knows who's been sick, you don't have a choice. You either lay down and let it take you over, or you stand up and then you live. To that point, I guess I just wanted people to know that everyone who has, is going through something, they're going to try to be positive for the people around them. But another one of my friends just has been going through brain cancer, and I just wanted her to know that you don't have to be okay for everybody around you. But that's my mentality. That's my Lutheran, like Midwestern. I want to make everybody feel okay. So if I feel bad, I can see it on my mom's face. If I'm feeling sick, it's hurting her. So I didn't want any of that to show for the family I wanted to protect. So it's very complicated, I guess, is the answer. And you know how complicated it is. And anyone who's been in this position and is listening or is dealing with a loved one who is sick, it's so complicated because you're so grateful for any chance that you get to feel better, but you still feel like shit. And so then you're angry and you're frustrated and you're worn down. But we had such a weird time in this world where we were able to insulate ourselves because we had to, because it was COVID and our community really took care of us. And we weren't going anywhere because we couldn't go anywhere. And I was used to touring and traveling, but I couldn't. And so I just had to like ask people, or I had to accept the help that was given to me. I shouldn't say ask because I wouldn't dare. But my friends hired a house cleaner to come in. They've delivered food. And I was feeling sheepish about that because I'm like, I can still cook. I'm fine. I'm fine. But actually, no, that was really nice to be taken care of. And the big lesson for me was, and I learned it when my dad was so sick, you learn from these things how to take care of other people as well. I keep that with me when you hear. We always say that, Chad and I, when we go through hard things, when he lost his job or you went through infertility or you have a really sick parent, like we've gone through, we say, oh, now we know what that feels like. And if you know what that feels like, you can be compassionate to the next person as you are. And as people who cared for us were, because they know what it's like. And you don't want to know what it's like. But now we do, and we have to take that and do something with it. And that was the biggest lesson for me. But I remember Chad saying, I said to him on our way home from the lake with the girls in the back before I had this surgery, that was scary. Like, what if I don't live through this? Should I start writing notes to the girls? What am I supposed to do here? I'm feeling fine now, but what's happening? And he's like, well, that's not an option. And I just needed him, even though it might've been bullshit, because it definitely is an option and it is bullshit. And I'm sorry if I can't swear.
You totally can swear. It's encouraged.
But I needed to hear him say that. Like, I'm not thinking that. We're going to be fine. And I can't imagine how scared he was, but I just needed us both to. So I cried a little there, and then that was it. And I just did it. And I just took it one step at a time. And I think that's all you can do. Specifically, like, I have to have this procedure done, and after that, we're going to go out to eat, you know, and just looking at the thing that's going to be nice and make me feel good after the bad thing happens. And that's helped me in my life, just in always just thinking about the next good thing that will happen after the shitty thing that's happening. And I think that's a nice tool for people to use and take with them, because it might have been ice cream after my big surgery. It was going to the lake in Minnesota and seeing and being with the girls for a week. And I knew that if I could get to that point, I could get to any other point in the journey. So yeah, it was wild.
I love that. I feel like you heard it here first, listeners. You look for the niceties after the bad shit. And I say that a little tongue in cheek, because I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. I feel like I'm talking to Brené Brown. She just unloaded like 19,000 things. If my pen and hand would go faster, I should have taken notes. But so much to unpack, Jesse. I so much appreciate your openness, especially even with infertility, and you know that you worked so hard to get these two baby girls here, and you just couldn't imagine life without them. And I know that resonates with listeners. I know that's something hard to talk about. One time I was eating lunch with a friend, and I love her dearly, and she said this, and she was very serious, and it had been such a big part of her life. She and her husband had struggled to have a baby and through infertility, and I believe used IVF, and now they have like these beautiful two children. And we were talking about like my illness and how, you know, surprise, I'm pregnant at the end. And she dead serious looked at me and she's like, Jackie, the groups of like infertility people I'm in would totally hate you. Oh. And I was like, that was a lot of perspective and thought. And it's just, we could talk about that forever, right? Like the unfairness of life. And that is an eternal question I have for God. Like, how can some people, you know, have babies when they have drug habit or meth habit, or, you know, and I'm not even using that to pass judgment. I'm just kind of, but yet like these couples we all know that are just warm and welcome and loving, and like, they can't have babies. Right. So eternal questions to God, you know, then there's the eternal questions to God of like, wait a minute, I'm responsible with taking care of these children. And like, now I have the uncertainty of cancer and I'm just trying to like clean my house and stay alive. So we kind of go back to this uncertainty. But I think you added in another thing there that's so important, community. And this is another thing I touch upon when I speak and write. You know, sure, I think you and I have shown to be resilient people given our stories. Like, oh, great. Yeah, but what about our communities? And to me, I think the community that surrounded me and like my village and my kitchen table, that meant more to my becoming like not someone who died from autoimmune encephalitis, but someone who can say I'm in remission. It's that community. And I love to hear you too saying, I asked for help, but then you had to correct yourself and be like, actually, I had to accept people helping me. Another one of the reasons I should have a tally of why Jesse and Jackie are, you know, boneheads, but in synchronicity. So like, tell me what it meant to have your community as your the first stage. Oh my God, what is this? It's cancer. The second stage, okay, we got to get this surgery and they have to like move my lungs and my heart. And then the third stage of I'm trying to recover and get back to my singing career. Like, what did your community mean to you in all of that?
I remember after, well, they wanted to do more for me and I wouldn't allow it. some of those crowdfunding things or like the financial side of things, there were people asking if they could do that for us. And I was, no, we don't need that kind of help. And I also compared myself, and I don't know, I don't think this is probably the right thing to do, but like, I'm alive, I'm good. I don't, after, we came home, I knew that I wouldn't have to have radiation and that they got all the cancer. And so in my mind, I'm like, I'm not a sick person anymore. I don't, everyone go put their energy into someone that really needs it. Like, I'm okay now. And it was really hard for me to just say, yeah, just say, yeah, sure, you can do this for me. Yeah, sure, you could do a fundraiser. I wouldn't like allow it. But then there's a time where you look at your family and your my husband and what was put on him, and not that he can't handle it, but then it's like, no, actually, just let them help you because they, well, first of all, you need it, you dummy. Like, you need someone to cook. Like, just, it's nice and you need it and you would do it for them and you want to do it for them. Like, the only thing you want to do for someone in your life that you love that is going through something is to make them your casserole. Just let me come over and fold some towels. Like, I can't, because everything else is so much out of their control. And so I had to kind of flip that over and be like, of course, they can't do anything. They want to do something. This is the thing they can do for me. And then I laid back into it, and it was a huge step in healing. And then you see who's there for you in real time, where sometimes you can feel isolated in your life and your work and your everyday, and maybe you feel like there no one's on the same page or you're not on the same level. There's a lot that happens in your big life, but in the little section of it where it, when it all, is all going to shit, that's where you see who your people are. And it might be people that just sign up for meal train that you didn't even know that they even knew where you lived, or but it's because it's a small town, but it's a changing town. So to answer that question, that's what that was like. I mean, I couldn't hold my kids on my lap, let alone like, be up for putting them to bed or pushing them on the swing. So to have, well, my family's right here on the ranch with me and my other sister's in town. So she, they, my kids didn't miss a beat. They had their aunt, they had their uncles, they had their grandma and grandpa, they had me that had a big old owie, and they don't remember it because it wasn't disruptive to their life really. And that's such a thing that I'm so grateful for, because they took care of me, but they took care of my family too. And that's a huge thing. They took some burden off of my husband and sent me just the simple things like gift cards to go back to Mayo for another checkup and a little package of goodies, like all of those things that make your life easier. If anyone's looking to figure out how to serve someone in this situation, it doesn't have to be a grand gesture at all. It's, yeah, making food or just $100 bill to so you can eat while you're at Mayo Clinic for that 7 days. I mean, there's doesn't have to be $100 bill even. It can just even be a nice card that just says, you got this and I'm thinking of you. Those make a, it sounds trivial, but this, that makes a big difference. And it just makes you feel, well, love has, is a healing power. People are in, my dad said this about, not to get into the weeds, but it's, we compare a little bit. He had a near death experience. Well, a few times. I keep telling him, like, stop trying to die. You're not good at it. Like, this is the third, fourth time. Just quit it. You're killing your, we're taking lives off of your loved one's life, or years off of our lives. But he had a life flight at one point. He had an aortic dissection and he should have been dead immediately. And we got the phone call in the middle of the night at the ranch, and we're 30 miles from anywhere. My mom was gone. It was middle of the winter. It was hell. And we didn't know what was happening to him. But once, long story short, he had to get in an airplane, and I thought it was the last time I was ever going to see him. He got to get, had to get in the helicopter to get life flighted to Bismarck, and they ultimately saved his life there. But he remembers feeling like he had a moment where he felt everybody's prayers in that process. And I'm not particularly overly religious, but I do believe that there's power in just if you can accept people's love and good vibes, if that's what you want to send them, or positive energy, or whatever it is that you call it. I've seen it in my dad's recovery from two major illnesses where he wanted to give up. And then my something that someone said will bring you to the point of like fighting more and fighting harder, or taking that just final step there is to take to maybe not give up when you want to give up. So there's just power in all of the energy people send your way, and that it makes you feel like, okay, let me be more succinct, that you're still needed here. So they're taking care of you because there's other things they, and I like to be useful. So there's other things I need to do here. So let's get me better. And then I can go help you all out. And that's how it felt to me. So
much more that Brené said there that I could really unpack, but a few of the things I heard, just like showing up, and I use this a lot, you know, when I talk about resilience, just show up. And if you're the person with the cancer diagnosis or the autoimmune encephalitis diagnosis, you might just have to show up for life. And that might be just getting out of bed, and that might be the best you can do. And so, 'cause your house is on fire. But, you know, if the circle of life, oh, did I quote Elton? I did.
You should. Yeah.
The circle of life is just like, yeah, but then somebody else's house is going to be on fire someday. And when yours isn't, you know, that you can show up. And I agree. Gestures, large and small, are all remembered, and they are so powerful. And I've said the same, like you can feel it when all these people are pulling for you and praying. And that's kind of where you're like, all right, well, I guess I better, you know, like Chad looking at you and saying, not an option. Or Dr. Dunnigan looking at me when I'm like, am I going to have more seizures? Terrified. And he's like, don't. Right. Okay, then. So we're back to what? Perspective, community, showing up. Something I really want to explore though too, Jesse, is you were creative before and I was not creative. There's something called being a lawyer, and you learn early, like there's no creativity. You're copying people that were wearing powdered wigs. And I was like, sign me up. This is great for me. I don't have a creative bone in my body. So you were already creative. How do you think, you know, your diagnosis and like this very much new perspective of life, of learning about pain and struggle and asking for help, and I think also learning, you probably were too stubborn to admit it, but that you had helped a lot of people in their time of need by folding their towels and making them a hot dish. So you learned too about yourself and your generosity. Like, how have all of these life lessons shaped your creative life?
For me, as a storyteller and a songwriter, when I was growing up, and you mentioned kind of my musical journey, I just was in love with folk music and songs that told a story. And I was the kid that liked Lyle Lovett's song about an old drunk guy that would waltz and fool was my favorite song, about the town drunk dancing in the bar in his overshoes. 7-year-old kid loved that song by Lyle Lovett. Why? Because it's a story about a human that's being human. And I wanted to know that person so much. And I wanted to write songs about people that weren't perfect, that had little flaws, that had character, even since I've been drawn to that since I was a little kid. But you have to have life. There's life experience in there. And if you keep your eyes open, and I'm a writer who writes every week, I have a deadline. I've learned through my infertility. I learned it early on when Chad and I were trying to have a baby for 10 years in our relationship, and just had a lot of loss and a lot of frustration, and moved back home to a place that I grew up on. And that was changing completely overnight because of the oil boom. There was a lot happening in there, a lot of life that I was perked up for because I wanted to tell this story. But then I had to remind myself that to be a good artist, there's so much vulnerability that you have to take on in order for it to be, for me to make it worth it. So I've been really open as a writer about, and I'm talking about the column here, or what I'm putting out into the world as like these personal essays for the column and the blog, my infertility story, because I quickly realized nobody had talked to me about any of the stuff that can happen in miscarriage and things like that when you're trying to start a family. Not one person in my life had that experience they shared with me. So I knew honesty was going to be the best policy in my column writing, but it's always kind of been in my songwriting because the messy stuff, the hard stuff, my favorite songs are sad songs. Like, I wanted the saddest song, and I want to, you know, that's just the way it is. But becoming a mother has shaped the way I write about love, because it opened something up in me that I didn't know yet. You tap into it, you grow. I think the older I get, the better I become at sharing those things through song and poetry and putting it out there. It's harder to do it because your time is limited and it's separated and spaced out. To be honest, like I used to be able to be so prolific because I had all this time to myself. And now it's more like just staying wide awake to what's happening around you and figuring out how you could communicate that feeling into some piece that might resonate with someone else. And that particular process to me is so fulfilling that I don't care if I ever was sang on a stage necessarily again, except that I want to connect people. The connection that people have to what I write about is so powerful when it happens. And it's not when they can come up to you and say, that song made me feel like you heard me or you saw me, or I'm not alone. This piece of writing makes me feel like I'm seen. That's why I do it. And it's not to be anyone's therapist. It's just that it's therapy for me. And so I think the more experience you have, then you kind of, as a creative person, have a little bit of a, I put the responsibility on myself to try to put that into a narrative or put that into a piece of music, because that kind of also validates the experience that you had, right? It's kind of like getting a tattoo or something. Like, I went through this. It's like the scar I have on my chest. And maybe you have some of that where other people might feel inclined to hide it. And I just want to like, I want you to see it because I lived through this. And any other person that was in my situation that didn't get to live would have gladly walked around with this scar. And so that's what I kind of feel like with the music and the writing is like, I have to speak it and sing it out loud because it happened, because it's happening to other people, because it's in here and it needs to be out there so that we can actually process it. So that's a little bit more. You know, when you're writing, for me as a creative person, I just always have been this way. I've always written it all down. I've always sang it at the top of my lungs. The nature part of it, being out at the ranch, has been so healing always for me. The landscape and the work out here and the horses and the, you know, the wide open space, that is all connected in the music and the work that I write. And I feel like my experience as a human is so much connected to this landscape. And just you've said the circle of life, but boy, nothing's more poignant to you than what the circle of life actually is than waking up every morning on a ranch, you know. And I've just always felt like that story needs to be told. And so that's why I keep trying. I didn't think I would do another album as a 40-year-old person and woman, especially because I didn't think growing up, this is a whole nother thing, that women musicians and entertainers were going to be, I was going to be irrelevant after a certain age, because that's just what you see. So I thought if I didn't get it all done in my 20s, then I wouldn't do it anymore because no one valued that. And I quickly learned like, well, who gives a shit? Like I need to keep writing. This is what I do. And it's changing. The industry is changing. There's more room and space for people and women, especially of all ages and demographics and whatever, to tell their story, and there's ears for it. But I had to write it down. I started writing a little bit more about motherhood in my music. And then I had a couple singles I wanted. And then all of a sudden it opened up a well that I needed to write another album. And I think you've probably found that in your creative journey, is once you open whatever the little gate that was closed, you'll find it. And once you open it a crack, if it needs to be open, psh, it all just comes out.
I love it. Kind of the sliding glass door of life. And mine was probably a sliding glass door moment in good and bad ways. My journey with AE and like the loss of being a lawyer. But instead of diving into that, because no one wants to talk about lawyers, I heard you say human a few times, the word human. And you said it was a song about humans being human, which made me think of a John Prine song, yes, like the best folklore. Yeah. You love John Prine. I saw his song that came out, I remember specifically, because I was like so embroiled in it, not at all thinking about it, in college. And he wrote the song, Some Humans Ain't Human. Mm-hmm. And I want to take kind of a weird path on this, kind of as we start winding down. I think you've shown a lot about strength and gratitude and kindness. But what about, because I get asked this a lot, like, what do people say, or what about this? Or I don't know, maybe I offer it, but I always say, like, intent goes a long way with me. And if I can tell people are asking really genuine things, they might say the wrong thing, because it's humanity, we're trying to help, and sometimes we say the wrong things. So like, I've had some of that. And again, if there's a good intent, I let a lot of it go. But what about sometimes when you're on this journey? Because I think this will resonate with listeners. You feel maybe misunderstood. You're already sick and you don't want to be. You're having to ask for help and that's not your nature. You're trying to do the best you can. What about when, like, the community isn't there, or it's not all flowers and roses, or you're a musician, you're out there publicly, like that can open itself up to critique. How have you dealt with the critics that maybe, and I'm saying this not just hypothetically, like personally too, that maybe don't believe in your journey or don't believe the way you've handled it or would change things. Like, how do you deal with the critics kind of in your cancer kind of ish life, and then your creative life? Like, how have you dealt with that?
That's a really good question because it's been hard for me, and I do want to make sure people know that it has not been all flowers and roses. To pick a job like I've picked, and I don't know, or it picked me, whatever it is, where you're trying to have a creative profession in the middle of nowhere. And it started when I was 16 years old. And I, in the 90s, when there was no such thing as YouTube, I mean, you can start like way back where you're, the only way people are going to hear you is you singing on the flatbed trailer of a fair and festival somewhere in the middle of another middle of nowhere. And for me, I had a dad that was a musician too. And he was really grounded in his sense of who he was and who he is, and my mom too, and why they were here and why they're in the middle of nowhere, because this is where he loves, this is his passion. So I got to see a lot of passion played out in my life in from my parents and my people that are surrounding me, and I mean my relatives mostly, because we're all cut from the same cloth. So I could have the example of people leading creative lives, and that's I saw that as something that made people more at peace with themselves in a world where you have to maybe have six jobs to get by. And that is something that maybe I internalized. So now I have six jobs and am driving myself crazy, you know. So maybe that's something we all need to go to therapy for. It's like, you can sit down, everybody. Can we just sit down for a second? But I had critics for sure, and do still at the beginning of my journey, though, when you're like told to get out of here when you're a kid and there's nothing for you back here. And I was writing songs and thinking I would like to keep doing that. And I remember touring up and down the Midwest when I was a college student. And I did that while I was studying communication because we all needed a fallback, right? You can't be a singer. There was never someone that told me that I could. There was no example of someone like me from the middle of nowhere going and making it. Maybe Jewel from Alaska was someone I watched do that. And she had a different reason for going and living in her car. She had like no other choice, right? I had a pretty great childhood. I could just go be an accountant and be fine, right? But I just couldn't do that. That's not in me. And I probably wouldn't stay married if I was an accountant because Chad would divorce me in a second. And anyways, long story, but I remember coming back home because the oil industry had been happening. Chad came back to take a job. And there's a lot of like nuance attached to that, like that you're attached to an industry like agriculture and oil. That can demonize people, demonize that side of our lives too, and not understanding the industry or why we're here. And that's a story for another day. But I came back and I was working in a new restaurant in Watford, and I was also touring, and I was at home on the ranch. And one of these people from my hometown that I'd worked with, who's, you know, like my parents' age, looked at me as I served him his pop or whatever. And he was like, "Oh, 4 years of college and you're back home waiting tables, huh?" And he thought he was being funny. And I was so pissed at him. And I just can feel my face like flushing up because that's not how I saw it. I saw it as coming home and being where I needed to be and I was doing this so I could do the next thing. And I was freaking 23 years old. Like, what do you want me to be doing? So I take it as fuel a little bit. but I also think criticism allows you for the chance to like, why is it pissing you off so much that someone said that to you? Is it because you believe it about yourself? Because if you believe it about yourself, then there might be some changes that you need to make. If that makes you so mad because you don't want to be, and that's what I did. I didn't want to be a waitress in my hometown. I didn't want to be there, but there was a reason. And I wasn't going to stand there and tell them what it was. So I will get really, take things really personal, even like silly things that people will write to me. I had a couple really mean emails in my career as a writer, putting it all out there, just assuming I was something that I'm not. But then I have to think to myself, are you doing the things that you want to do? Or is it some of these critics, is some of it true? And then if it isn't, you got to kind of brush it aside and keep going. But if there's some truth in it and it's getting to you, then there's some work that you need to do. And there's a lot of different hats that I wear. And I think I get more frustrated in my job as an arts advocate in our community. I run an arts program when you think that you know what's, and I'm just, I think I know what's best. You guys want this, you know, like I'm going to bring this guy in my board or whatever. This is not a true example, but this great musician to town or this great poet, and you want this. I know you want this. Everyone just listen to me. You're going to love it. And then like four people show up and you're like, what the hell is wrong with people?
What is wrong with everyone? You love this.
Yeah. It's you. But that, then you could just quit. It'd be like, well, nobody wants this. Everybody, you know, they just don't get it. They don't understand. But the four people that came did. And so that's where I find like the direction and the motivation to keep going and keep trying, because little things that you do, big things that you do can have a small impact, and little things that you do can have a big impact. And if I believe in it, I like can't physically stop myself from doing it. And that is the truth. And my husband is down there right now, I'm sure listening to me like, oh my God, it's sometimes I have to say, just because it's a good idea doesn't mean you have to do it, Jesse. So I've had to kind of like go back and forth about that sometimes, like really self-evaluate and think, are you taking on too much? That's always been my thing that I have to regulate a little bit, because if I take on too much, then I'm not good for anybody. And there's a lot of focus that I have to switch between a lot. And sometimes I do it fine, but sometimes I get to town and I don't have a bra on. And when people ask me that, when she asked me that question and why I answered it, that why I even mentioned it is because people will ask me, how do you do it all? It seems like you, you know, have it all together and, you know, you do all these things and da, da, da. And when you list it and you're, and I think everybody, if you listed everything down on a resume and read it out loud to a crowd, everyone has these accomplishments. It's just, and everyone is still also trying to get supper on the table and is failing. And right now my whole house is full of sawdust because we're doing addition at the same time as a million other things. And I don't do it well all the time. And I also have a good support system. So anyway, and then sometimes you run out the door and you forget like a essential piece of your clothing, and then you might have it in your car, as I did, an extra one, because you never unpack your car because you don't have time, right? Because you're gone to the next thing. So
that's right. Yeah. You had the bra in the car. Oh, that makes the story even better. Oh, Jesse, I love it. So I heard like three super important things in that. I heard one, that you don't have to apologize for wanting to lead a creative life. And I think that's awesome. And I do agree with you that like now YouTube and TikTok, it has leveled the playing field and allowed people with like little talent like me to enter into. And that's exciting. Like, you don't have to apologize. I think the second thing I heard you say is you don't always have to explain yourself, whether it be your illness or whether you're choosing to wait tables so you can write songs. And I think the third thing I heard is perseverance. And maybe that's the best answer of like on life's journey with chronic illness, or the journey of kind of how do I deal with my inner critic and other critics, like perseverance. So I think you wrapped that up really nicely. And I think that's the perfect time to take us to the rapid fire. I haven't even written these down. These are coming off the top of my head. So, first rapid fire question is if I made you sing and you had to pick between three songs right now, if I asked you to sing Queen of My Double Wide Trailer, John Deere Green, or Dear Abby, Dear Abby, which song
Oh.
would you pick?
Well, John Deere Green, probably, because it reminds me of riding the bus to and from school in the 90s. And like, I'm all right. You say those two, Queen of My Double Wide Trailer and John Deere Green. I'm back in George's bus number, whatever, three, going to town, and it's dusty and it's hot. And I'm like upside down talking to my little friend. And we've been on the bus for 30 minutes. And yeah, I can smell it. That's
Oh
the
my
one
gosh.
I.
This is why you need to look Jessie up online. I read this, I think it was one of her newspaper columns, and it was on her blog about her grandma's blue lipstick. And this is the way she talks and the way she writes, and it's like super beautiful. Her hot, dusty smell of the bus from John Deere Green. Love, love all that. That is an important song to me because that was a song my dad and I shared together, and we shared a Joe Diffie concert in high school when I never went on dates. And like this one boy said he'd take me to the concert, and then he ignored me. And he actually called my brother and made plans. And I was like, I hate you and we'll never talk to you again.
Oh, that wasn't thought out by him very well.
So mean. So mean. And so my dad took me on a date to Joe Diffie. So when my dad died last year in May, that was like a song I went back to a lot, John Deere Green. So I love that it has special meaning to both of us. Okay, second, what is more fun, singing or playing your guitar?
Oh, singing. I'm not a great guitar player. I only play guitar so I can write music and accompany myself, but I hate practicing. Blech, blech. I wish I was a better guitar player. I am jealous of every guitar player, not jealous enough to do anything about it.
Love
Lazy
it.
guitar player.
Most important question. Most important. What's your favorite Elton John song?
Built in. Well, probably anything in any movie that he does. Anything. So, but your Circle of Life, the Lion King, yeah. Elton.
Hey.
My mom went to Elton John. Yeah, we bought her tickets. If you don't know what to get your mom, get her concert tickets.
Get her concert tickets to Elton John. Ugh, that is. Why is Elton John one of the greatest and longest enduring artists of our time, in your
I
opinion?
should take back Circle of Life because that was on my head. Tiny Dancer is definitely my favorite Elton song. I think, and God bless him, the longevity that he's had, but the lyricism and just the showmanship, he has everything, you know, the showmanship, the lyrics, the storytelling, the unabashedly just being who he is. And I love that it kind of transcends any of the, you know, the bullshit that humans do to each other. It doesn't matter. It's Elton. He can do whatever he wants. And I love it.
Love that. Can't argue with Elton. You are the second person on this podcast to say that he is unabashedly himself, which I think is awesome that we strike a common chord on the Brain Fever podcast about Elton.
About
And I think that just means it's a great place to land. So what I want to say is I want to share Jessie with the world. She's super easy to find, like Jessie Beter Music, Jessie Beter. Just Google her, you'll find her music. You can stream her, you'll find her blogs. Like, she's got great websites to maneuver. You can find her there. I was listening to her on Apple. I know she's on Spotify. I really see, this is where life gets weird, but I'm thankful for autoimmune encephalitis because without it, there would not be this podcast, and I wouldn't be with Jessie on a Friday morning. And I would not have been in that like hotel ballroom sitting next to braless or maybe broad
I
Jessie.
was broad then, yeah.
She was broad, sitting next to Jessie, learning about her, becoming a dear friend. And I admire the heck out of you. So today I can say I'm thankful for my wretched chronic illness because now I have this great friendship with you, and I got to share you with the world today. So thank you.
Well, back at you. I love what you're doing. I love your honesty. I think it's so refreshing to have these conversations about these hard things that have happened to us. Our instinct as Midwesterners and women, I think, is to push it all down and push it down and push it down. But I love the movement of living it out loud. I think I had no choice. I think the two of us were just built this way to just speak it. It comes out. I can't help it. And when you're talking about intention and things like that. Sometimes people ask how you live with intention or how you just persevere. I just wanted to put a pin on that. That perseverance, sometimes I think when we're trying to be motivational with people, sometimes I'm like, but how do you do it? I think, and I tell this to a lot of my students when I'm talking with them, you know more about yourself at 16, at 12, at 11 than anyone ever gave you credit for. So now when you're 35, 25, 45, think back on who you were and what you loved to do when you were 12 years old. And I think that will open up a whole world to what direction you're supposed to be going. And that doesn't necessarily mean your career, but just for yourself to be who you are. There's a lot to who you were when you were 12 years old. And sometimes that perseverance is just, it's in you. You just have to like, let it be what it is. And I think that's all I've done in my life is just follow that little instinct that I've had to not, it, what my body physically doesn't allow me to do anything other than that. And that, I don't know if that's helpful to people, but I hope it sort of is, to give yourself a little bit of grace to listen to yourself a little bit more.
I think that is helpful. I think it's saying that not only Elton gets to be unabashedly himself and cut through all the bullshit that like we all do. So just keep swimming, folks. That's going to conclude this episode, a new season of the Brain Fever Podcast. And with that, thank you, Jesse and Sean. Take us out.
Crumbs drop to your kitchen floor, and then the tears a little more. Days that seem to last too long, you reach for him. A girl needs a dog. Words unsaid to anyone, he warms your feet, you softly hum. Listening to your quiet songs, big ears, big heart. A girl needs a dog. A girl needs a dog in times like these. Some hope and a plan, clarity. A girl needs a bike or her own car keys. A girl needs a dog. Hey, 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 yeah. Hey, 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 yeah. Things that go bump in the night. Slamming doors, a stupid fight. Someone who understands who's wrong. You climb in bed. A girl needs a dog.